Here's an easy way for you to publicize Issues Etc. at your church. Go to the promote page of our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find a short paragraph to include in your weekly church bulletin. Help inform your fellow parishioners about Issues Etc. issuesetc.org. Click promote and copy and paste the text for your church secretary or pastor to include each week in the Sunday bulletin. We update this paragraph weekly. Go to the promote page of our website, issuesetc.org.
Can you actually see a time when we'd have a prehistoric park, like an entertainment?
You know, if you'd asked me that question just 2 years ago, I'd have said no. But there's been some real developments in scientific techniques in the last few years that have actually changed my opinion. And I think it's conceivable now that it could be produced.
That's an excerpt from an NBC Today show story titled, Can Dinosaurs Roam the Earth? Again, of course, we're all familiar with the Jurassic Park scenario. Well, at the time the movie was made, based on that famous book, it was considered science fiction. I think that's where you would have found the book, in the bookstore, on the science fiction shelf. And now there are those who say, well, we just found this baby mammoth that was so well preserved that they believe there is genetic material. They can at least extrapolate some genetic material from this animal that's supposed to be hundreds of thousands of years old. And what about the dinosaurs that are supposed to be hundreds of millions of years old? At least the fossils left of them are. They say, maybe it's not science fiction after all. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We'll talk dinosaurs with Dr. David Menten here in the first half hour of this hour of the program. We're coming to you live this Wednesday afternoon, the 2nd of September. Our call-in number for the next hour, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MIE. After our conversation on dinosaurs, we'll be talking with Dr. Vern Poitras of Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia about gender inclusivity and a forthcoming revision of the now famous New International Version of the Bible, the NIV. We'll talk about how they fiddle with pronouns sometimes when they revise these Bible translations. 1-877-623-6943. You can email us, talkback at issuesetc.org. Or if you're following us on Twitter, send us a tweet at issuesetc, at issuesetc. Dr. David Menten is a regular guest, speaker for Answers in Genesis, Associate Professor Emeritus of Anatomy at Washington University School of Medicine. Dr. Menten, welcome back.
Well, thank you.
I've heard you say, you've said on this program many times, that the fossils, even the ones considered to be most ancient in the extreme, are not in fact hundreds of millions of years old, but tens of thousands, if not less. Do you think it is science fiction to extract from these fossils old or new genetic material?
Well, you know what? The problem is, we don't know that something, for example, is 60 or 70 million years old. There's no way to be certain of that. There's no really independent way to determine that, and I don't believe the Bible allows for that kind of time on Earth anyway. But what do we know in terms of old tissues and efforts to look at DNA and protein? We have Egyptian mummies, for example. Egyptian mummies, we have independent evidence, not radiometric dating, but historical evidence are, say, in the range of around 3,000 years old. And there have been a number of attempts over the years to look at skin from these mummies. A lot of times the organs were removed from the Egyptian mummies, so you have skin and muscle on the body wall and what have you. And we know that when you look at something known to be 3,000 years old, you certainly aren't going to reproduce any Egyptians from the DNA. There have been protein fragments, not completely intact proteins, from specimens known to be 3,000 years old. So we have pretty good evidence that DNA is not going to be well preserved at 3,000. Now, if evolutionists were correct that dinosaurs died off, say, 65 million years ago, we know that at 3,000 there isn't much left. What would you expect if it were really 65 million? Rather, I assume the dinosaurs that we found are probably not that much older than the Egyptian mummies. And I would expect comparable sort of preservation. Indeed, recent studies by Dr. Mary Schweitzer and others on soft tissue that has been, in fact, found in dinosaur bones, there are protein fragments in this tissue, and nobody is really talking much about DNA at this point.
All right. So if there is no Jurassic Park scenario in our immediate future, let's do talk about these creatures that did once roam the Earth. I think you might argue still do, closer to the ground, smaller form. But let's talk about what most people consider the, no pun intended, rock-solid evidence for their great antiquity, and that is the fossil record itself. Tell us what we're really seeing in the fossil record worldwide. What are we really seeing in this? We're told layer upon layer of a fossil record that shows us many different eras and rise and falls of many different species over tens of millions of years. But what are we really seeing in the fossil record?
Well, you know, it's interesting. About 95% of the fossil record is marine invertebrates. A lot of people don't realize that, but that's really what we're looking at for the most part, are marine invertebrates. If you've ever picked up a fossil, like from a crushed rock driveway or gravel road, oftentimes you can pick up a fossil. Chances are very good that the fossil you picked up was a marine invertebrate. It was a clam, a coral, something, trilobite, some invertebrate that lives in the ocean. And of the remaining 5%, most of those would be plants. You have insects. By the time you get to creatures that have bones in them, you have significantly less than 0.1% of all fossils. And then if now you go even further and you say, well, we want to look at only those fossils that are dinosaurs or those fossils that are primates or whatever, you get into very, very tiny, small fractions of 0.1%. Now, that doesn't mean the fossils aren't out there. Obviously, you go to the museums, you see them, but we need to realize just how relatively rare these fossils are compared to marine invertebrates. And, you know, we don't see a ladder of life. Go to Grand Canyon and start at the bottom and walk up. This is the largest exposure to the geological column in North America. If you're ever going to walk up the ladder of life, that would be a good place to do it. And, in fact, you see no vector of progress going up the Grand Canyon. On the surface, the surface layers exposed there, we see the only evidence in the canyon of sponges, which are supposed to be the earliest form of multicellular life on Earth. Once again, you find worms and marine invertebrates throughout the thickness of the canyon. Three layers down from the top in the Coconino, you find footprints of vertebrates, presumably both amphibians and reptiles. But no one has ever found, to my knowledge, a fossilized bone in Grand Canyon. This is supposed to be a cut through life, the fossil record of life from the basement rocks of the Earth, which of course wouldn't be expected to have living things in them, or fossils of living things, from the basement rocks up to the age of the reptiles, and no one has ever found a fossilized bone in Grand Canyon. Footprints, yes. Bones, no. Are we to believe that footprints evolved millions of years before feet? So the fossil record, the point is, doesn't give us this beautiful stepladder, as it were, going up step by step through life. There's a great deal of sort of playing around with dates and reorientation. Now, it is true you tend to see invertebrates, particularly those that don't move about, shellfish and what have you, in the lower layers, and you tend to find vertebrates in the more superficial layers. But one would expect that from a global flood. Sessile or immovable organisms like clams and oysters and coral and what have you, you would expect to be buried in the deeper layers, and primates and what have you in more superficial layers.
Okay, so just the other day I was out moving some rock from a vacant lot near my house. I picked up this rock, and I saw all sorts of little invertebrates in there, fossilized, embedded in this rock. With only a minute, what's the simplest and most reasonable explanation for all those, and I'm right there up on the bluffs in southern Illinois, how they got there in that rock?
Well,
Dr. Menten.
There's no explanation that's more obvious to me than a global flood. The flood of Noah's day is the only thing that can really account for the production of fossils. When you think about it, fossils, by and large, are not being formed the day when your dog dies or your cat dies or the rabbits die in your backyard. They don't make fossils. It requires a sudden deposition of bodies in a sediment that's cementitious, that becomes hard very quickly before the bodies can completely decompose or predators can consume them. And those conditions, I believe, are just virtually unique to the global flood of Noah's day.
Dr. David Menten is our guest. We're talking dinosaurs. When we come back, how do we respond to the objection that is often said in connection with the flood? Well, if they were there before, and the flood account is an accurate historical record, these mammoth beasts, these gargantuan beasts, could not have fit on the ark. You didn't have a brontosaurus walking the decks of the ark. It just, you can't do the math. The volume doesn't add up, even by the biblical account. And when did the dinosaurs live? When did they die and why? What kind of questions or comments do you have on dinosaurs? It's Wednesday afternoon, the 2nd of September. We're talking with Dr. David Menten, a speaker for Answers in Genesis, associate professor emeritus of anatomy at the Washington University School of Medicine. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Our in-studio email address this Wednesday afternoon, talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org, or Twitter us at @issuesetc, @issuesetc. Stay tuned.
Sounds of rich liturgy and historic Christian worship. What a way to spend a Sunday morning. At Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt, Illinois, you'll find authentic Christianity as you hear the preaching of Christ crucified for the forgiveness of your sins. Come, join us Sunday mornings at 9 and Monday evenings at 7:30, and find out more about Trinity Lutheran Church, Millstadt, Illinois, at trinitymillstadt.org.
The leadership of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is proposing sweeping changes in structure and governance. These changes would further centralize power in the church's bureaucracy and decrease the voice of LCMS congregations and laity. Stay informed. Read the new broadcast transcripts on this subject. You'll find them at the top of the on-demand page at issuesetc.org. These transcripts are a must-read for every layperson and pastor in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Issuesetc.org. Click on demand.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues, etc.
Are you uncomfortable with making an online credit card donation? Well, here's an option for you. Call me at 618-223-8382, and I'll personally take your credit card donation and process it for you. Hi, this is Craig Feidinger of Lutheran Public Radio. Call me today, 618-223-8382, and make a secure credit card donation to help support Issues, etc. 618-223-8382.
Have you heard of the CLCC, the Confessional Lutherans for Christ's Commission? We're deeply involved in providing seminars to build up Christ's church with education and training for the laity. So far, we've held seminars on confessional topics at churches in Minnesota, Utah, Oregon, and Washington, and planning is underway to hold seminars in several other states coast to coast. Visit theclcc.org. Check us out. Get on the mailing list, or better yet, join us. See how your church can host a seminar, too. Go to theclcc.org.
We're talking about the dinosaurs. Dr. David Menten is our guest of Answers in Genesis. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org. Twitter us at issuesetc, @issuesetc, or give us a call with questions or comments on the dinosaurs, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Okay, so you've made the case here that what we really have is in the fossil record, with regard to all the fossils, not just dinosaur fossils, a massive and global flood that deposited all the sediment and put these fossils in place. Then let's talk about where they were, what they were doing before. When did they live, the dinosaurs, and why aren't they around anymore for us to you know, look at and ride around on?
Well, I believe God would have created the dinosaurs on the sixth day of creation. All dinosaurs are terrestrial. Those creatures that swim in the ocean, the plesiosaurs and plesiosaurs, they're simply marine reptiles and or aquatic reptiles, very large, very interesting creatures, but they're not dinosaurs. And then those creatures that fly in the sky, the flying reptiles, the pterodactyls and what have you, again, terribly interesting creatures, some of them huge, but they're not dinosaurs. All dinosaurs are terrestrial creatures, and so I believe they would have been created in the sixth day. At the time of the flood, I would have to assume the dinosaurs were brought aboard at least the kinds, the created kinds of dinosaurs. We're told during the flood that God brought the creatures to the ark. Noah didn't have to go out and get them, so you can be sure that God picked the right stock that would repopulate the earth after the flood. And one doesn't have to put an adult dinosaur in the ark. I think a healthy juvenile would be better than some aged dinosaur. And when you realize the average size of a dinosaur is about the size of a sheep, a couple hundred pounds, you know, we tend to always think of dinosaurs as being huge, and the ones that fascinate us most are huge. But they are not the ones, they're not the only kinds of dinosaurs. There were some the size of chickens. So they say the average size is around 200 pounds. And then if you bring juveniles rather than adults, this significantly cuts down the size. And then if you realize it wasn't every dinosaur that we have a name for, a scientific name today, we need to be concerned about, but rather the kinds, the created kinds. And, for example, the stegosaurs that have that kind of a frill in the back, these dinosaurs appear to have been several different varieties or species of them that may, in fact, all represent the same kind of creature. So the total number of kinds of dinosaurs would not be as large as the total number of species that might have existed.
So is it your contention that the vast majority of these creatures, in fact, and along with, I would say, many species that predated the, or we would call them species, represented in their kinds on the ark, perished in the flood and were never heard from again?
Yeah, the Lord preserved, I would think, most of the creatures that certainly those having the breath of life, what were preserved, the kinds probably correlate most closely to what we would call a family of organisms today, or maybe a genus at the lowest. But after the flood, and I believe dinosaurs must have survived the flood because we have in the secular literature, we have records, many, many records from practically every continent of creatures described as dragons. I know there's a lot of mythology associated with dragons, but the interesting thing is every culture, it seems, has dragon legends, and the dragons all look basically the same when they've been illustrated. They look like very large, usually pretty frightening-looking reptiles that walk on legs. And many of them are shown as being three-toed and having spines down the back and a long tail and walking on four legs and what have you, looking very much like a dinosaur, certainly not like a cow or a cat or a chicken. They look like a dinosaur. And I believe that the dragon legends reflect man's familiarity and experience with the last of the dinosaurs. Probably they were killed out by man who hunted them, possibly after the flood. The conditions were so much inferior to before the flood, where we know from the fossil record there was just luscious, rich vegetation, even in South Dakota. You go into the Badlands today, it's hard to imagine anything surviving there that's alive. And yet you look at the fossil record, it must have been very much like a jungle at some point in history, I would say, before the flood. So since most dinosaurs, if not all of them, but certainly most dinosaurs are vegetarian, this is agreed on by evolutionists themselves, the only dinosaurs believed not to be vegetarian are the theropods, the type that T-Rex belongs to. They are believed to have been scavengers, but a recent scientific report shows that even some of the theropods appeared to have eaten plants. So the amount of foliage available for, say, large dinosaurs after the flood, you imagine all the trees are gone and everything has to kind of grow again. It must have whittled their numbers down considerably or kept them from, you know, repopulating more quickly than they did. And, of course, today I believe dinosaurs are extinct.
Some would say that, I guess there are two different schools of thought here. Some would say, well, the dinosaurs, those that did survive, whatever they, according to the evolutionary theory, some massive extinction that took place tens of millions of years ago, continued to evolve, the smaller ones, and they are now represented by birds. The older school would say, well, no, they survived, and now they are these land-dwelling reptiles, the large ones like crocodiles and alligators. What are your thoughts?
Well, there's a fundamental difference between a dinosaur and any other reptile that we know of today. For example, if you can just imagine a crocodile or an alligator walking towards you, you get a mental picture. The elbows and the knees are out. In other words, the belly is slung down between the legs. All alligators, monitor lizards, all these creatures walk sort of elbows and knees out with bodies slung down between the legs. When you look at dinosaurs, whether they walked on two legs like the theropods, like T-Rex, or whether they walked on four legs like the sauropods, they stood on top of their legs. Their legs went straight down under their body. We have no reptiles today that look like that. And as far as, you know, birds being dinosaurs, I think that's that's quite a stretch. They've even classified birds today under the Dinosauria. It shows you how keen the evolutionists are to hammer home that birds evolved from dinosaurs. The evidence for that, in my opinion, is not convincing, and certainly there's no compelling evidence that feathers evolved from reptile scales.
So when you mentioned before these dragon accounts. When we read, for instance, in Holy Scripture, and they're rather cryptic descriptions, but there are descriptions, Book of Job and elsewhere, of these large and bizarre creatures for which there is no apparent corollary in the animal kingdom today. Do you think it's likely that what's being described there is kind of the last dying gasp of the dinosaurs after the global flood?
Yeah, I think, you know, they obviously survived for some time after the flood. I mean, they weren't all lost. I believe they were represented in the ark along with other air-breathing creatures. And that they survived for some period of time. And we have a pretty good secular record in the literature of creatures that sound like they would be dinosaurs. And I think in the Bible, of course, we read about, creatures that are described as dragons, but to me, one of the most compelling creatures in the Bible that very likely could have been a dinosaur is the one that God mentions to Job called Behemoth. He said, look at Behemoth that I made along with you. In other words, on that same time in creation. And the description of Behemoth is having, you know, ribs like great bars of iron and a massive creature. I would be surprised if the Bible wouldn't mention them, since they are so amazing. And so Behemoth, you know, is described as having, you know, legs that were massive, a very large belly, a great tail. It swayed like a cedar tree. I mean, you look at the NIV Bible and I have an NIB study Bible, and it says when Behemoth is described having a tail that swayed like a great cedar tree, they suggest the hippopotamus or an elephant. Well, I don't know when the last
30
time
seconds
you saw the tail of those creatures. It's quite small.
Dr. David Menton, thank you very much for being our guest.
My pleasure.
Answers in Genesis has some excellent resources on dinosaurs. We'll post a link to these articles under the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org. Dr. David Menton is a speaker for Answers in Genesis and Associate Professor Emeritus of Anatomy at Washington University School of Medicine. When we come back from this break, he mentioned the NIV in passing, and one of the big stories in the world of Bible versions and translations is, in fact, the New International Version in a new revision. Now, some found it objectionable in a previous revision that the NIV dabbled in what's called gender-inclusive language, especially with regard to the divine person, turning he or she into something more generic. Why shouldn't Bible translators do this? We'll talk about gender-inclusive language in the forthcoming revision of the New International Version of the Bible. Dr. Vern Poitras of Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia will be our guest.
This is not like your normal study Bible.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Will Wheaton, on the new Lutheran Study Bible.
The wisdom of the church in meditating on the Word of God across the ages is supplied throughout the notes. There are citations from the Lutheran fathers, from the early church fathers. There are any wise, good thing that's been said on the basis of some text of the Bible, they've stuck it in there. It's got prayers, not just about an academic learning. What does this mean? The Bible is replete with these little devotional meditations. It gives you help in witnessing. How can you use this particular teaching from God's Word to bring others to Christ, to help them come to know what He's done for them? It's got great pictures. Well, you can tell I'm excited about it. And I was one who was said to be jaundiced and not appreciative of it.
You can purchase the new Lutheran Study Bible by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or you can browse before you buy at our homepage, issuesetc.org, the Lutheran Study Bible.
Giggle Free Radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Is abortion health care?
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
President Obama's agenda for nationalizing health care in America is going forward. Though uncertainty in Congress, based largely on citizen opposition to the sweeping changes, has stalled the bill briefly, some kind of reform will likely take place in the near future. What will this mean for the unborn? Sadly, many in Obama's camp, such as Secretary of State Clinton, explicitly include abortion in their definition of health care. This means that unless language in the legislation specifically protects unborn children, federal funding for abortion will be part of federally mandated health care.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.